The Spinoff Podcast Network. Skinny are helping you show how smart you are with the 1Q Quiz, an all-new, super challenging and super quick daily quiz built by The Spinoff. Every Monday, Skinny are giving you the chance to prove you're smart with the Skinny Extra Credit question. Get it right, and you'll get the chance to score yourself some Skinny Extra mobile credit so you can text, call, or even video call your group chat and gloat about how big your brain is. T's and C's apply. Ready to rediscover the joys of cycling? With over 300 kilometres of cycle paths across Tāmaki Makaurau, jumping on your bike and going for a ride is such a fun way to discover the city from a different perspective. Cycling is getting more and more popular across Auckland, so now's a great time to join the hype and give cycling a go. Head to at.govt/cycling to find your nearest cycleway today.
Tēnā koutou katoa, no mai, haramai ki Dietary Requirements, the Spinoff's food podcast. We like to hang out with the most interesting people in the New Zealand hospitality scene and talk about the environmental, social, political implications of what we eat. My name is Simon Day and I am joined as always by the Spinoff's food editor, Alice Neville. Kia ora, Alice.
Kia ora, Simon.
And food boss, Sophie Gilmore. Welcome.
Kia ora, Simon.
For the entire month of August, Visa Wellington on a Plate is serving up incredible culinary experiences, and we're really excited to be partnering with them in the lead up to the festival and then as an official event on the program. You can catch Dietary Requirements live in action on August 15, 3pm to 5pm at Parrot Dogs Lyle Bay Brew Bar. We'll be talking to the Mats from Parrot Dog about their 10th birthday, how you survive in the craft beer game for that long, and then speaking to some of the city's most exciting hospitality owners, personalities, characters about what the future of the industry could and should look like. Please come and join us, and please participate in the festival as much as you can. There are some incredible events across the month. Visit visawoap.com to plan your Visa Wellington on a Plate experience for 2021, which leads us to our guest today. Carlo Buenaventura is an iconic Auckland hospitality personality. You will have seen him on both sides of the pass at a number of fantastic spots around the city, but most recently you'll be able to find him at Bar Magda in Cross Street in the central city, where he is back on the tools in the kitchen. Welcome, Carlo. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Is it exciting to be in the kitchen?
Yes, very much so. Long time coming, and you know, can't be I'm very grateful to be back.
When was the last time you were cooking? Was that Cult Project?
Well, yeah, the Cult Project, but I've always been in the kitchen actually, just doing like some catering work, just
yes, sort
of keep me sort of grounded. So normally I do that even when I was managing Jamaisie. Sometimes I'll do like early morning shifts for catering companies, like 4 a.m. till like 10, and then do the bookings at Jamaisie.
Should we go all the way back to the start, to your whakapapa? So where does your family originally come from?
So Philippines. So I grew up I was born and raised in the Philippines, in Davao, Mindanao, the bottom south of the country. My family were originally from up north, but their families moved down south. So that's where I grew up. And then my career started in hospitality in the Philippines as well for about 2 years, and then I moved to New Zealand out of just curiosity of traveling, really.
When was that?
That was 2010.
Right.
Yeah, trying to get work placements initially in the US or Guam or Singapore, but ended up in New Zealand.
So like kind of accidentally ended up here?
Yeah, well, I wanted to leave. I was in that mentality of I want to do it now. And I couldn't wait like 6 months or a year when they were like, oh, you have to wait for a little bit because you don't have an opening until 6 months or a year. And then it was like, oh, but there's in New Zealand. I was like, all right, I'll take it.
And are you a resident now?
Well, I'm a Kiwi now, actually. Yeah.
Cool. That's great.
Yeah.
Lucky old New Zealand. That's so good. So you almost didn't come.
No, and you've, where have you worked in New Zealand?
New Zealand. So I first started working when I was in Queenstown at Crown Plaza. That was for about over 2 years. And then I moved to Wellington at Matterhorn.
Cooking?
Yes.
Yeah.
At Matterhorn. And that was both under Dave Verhol and then Jimmy Pask, who I'm doing the event with at Cinders.
So this is the Wellington on a plate event that we will get to in a
yeah,
minute.
Yeah, so that was the one. And I did a short stint before at Foxglove, just covering a head chef gig there before for a few months, just before I moved to Auckland and worked at Orphan's Kitchen. So that was technically like my last sort of proper restaurant kitchen gig, in that sort of sense. And then after that, I moved on doing floor and kitchen at Burger Burger. That was actually for a good couple of years too, which was really great. It really exposed me to a different side of hospitality. Been so used to just your atypical sort of smart casual or upscale sort of restaurant and being in a more fast-paced. That was a really interesting sort of learning curve for me. And then after that, I did mostly floor at Culprit and then Jimazy Street and also Love Bucket. And then the last one was I did a short stint at Hotel Ponsonby because I'm good mates with Kat. So,
how come you mix it up, do chefing and front of house?
That's
kind of rare, right?
I think it's quite important. Not only if you want to, not just if you wanted to start a business, but you know, if hospitality is a career that you want to pursue. It's quite interesting. This was actually this one incident when I was at Matterhorn. I had just started running the pass. I think that was like my first, second week. And then one of the senior wait staff asked me like, hey, could you plate it on a smaller plate? And I was like, no, I can't because this is what the chef had. And, you know, this is how we plate. This is how the chef wants it. My first day, Sunday, da, da, da. And I didn't want to make any changes. You know, I was just trying to sort of follow, like, you know, technically I was quite a robot back then as well. Like, you know, I wasn't really thinking like, right. And then my maitre d' was just listening. She just listened the whole time. And at the end of the shift, she just told me, well, you know, you weren't wrong. And she wasn't wrong either, but it would be good for you to see what she meant. And like
tiny table, no room for the plate.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, but like, but for me, I was like, what, you know, I was like, surely that should fit. And then we were having staff drinks. I told Jess, like, hey, I'm keen to learn front of house if, you know, if there's space. And she's like, yeah, you can. And then that was actually my first proper sort of front of house gig when I was at Matterhorn. So on my days off, I'd come in, do floor shifts for them. And then she would teach me, she'd put me in a section. And that's when I had a much better understanding. Okay, sweet. That's what they meant. It's not just the plates. It's also like, you know, cutlery plates, water glasses, cocktails. And if they want to have wine with a cocktail, so it's just fills up the room and understanding when, you know, when chefs
totally.
Would be like, I'll just call it away. They should be ready. I was like, now I know, like, nah, they're not ready. I just have to sort of like, you know, find a way to communicate to front of house team and be like, hey, can you ask them if they are done and if they're ready for the next course so we can start sending? Otherwise, we won't be able to turn the tables.
Otherwise, it's a shit show for everyone involved. Yeah.
Yeah, so and that's where, when I sort of really learned
the other perspective,
and then just gave me a better idea of how I wanted to manage myself and also manage a team, you know, and also seeing that like front of house does also work hard, you know, it's just a different
type of work,
type of stress, you know, the amount of mental stress that a front of house person gets is actually quite draining because you are facing like hundreds of people, different personalities. And
it's like you're an actor. The show must go on,
yeah.
You know?
And you're dealing with them one-on-one. So it's like you have table one, which is a different personality. You have table two, table three, and that's all different sort of like mental stress. And it's a lot to sort of actually take on. And so I commend like everyone that's like working in front of house because it is something else.
Using that actor's metaphor, you have to do like eight different characters at the same
time.
Totally.
Yeah.
I think that's so important. I think all chefs should have to work in front of house, and all waiters should have to go back and chop some onions and do some prep and debone some salmon and learn each other's roles a bit more to get that communication down.
Yeah. That reminded me of the, you know, when Chan Sarawat wrote the open letter to the Prime Minister about calling our industry low skilled.
Yeah.
And I thought it was really interesting because actually, like you said, there's a huge amount of EQ and energy that goes into making the day of 12 different groups of people at the same time. Like feeding and watering them is kind of just the like vehicle for what you're actually doing. You're creating a whole experience for them. And it's, yeah, it's totally different to the technical skill of a chef, but it's also not it's equally as valid. And
it
I think
it's like emotionally draining.
Yeah.
Totally.
And I think that like you say, the divide, which I think's stupid and a bit old school anyway, between the back of house and the front of house, it's just a fallacy. Like we're all on the same team. We all want the same result. So, you know, like you say, let's work together and understand not just the what, but the why we're doing things.
So Bar Magda has a real Filipino touch to it. Is this the first time you've got to cook with your own sort of style and food?
No, actually, at the Cold Project, it's always been sort of our style. It started off first with Will and I. Will, who I used to work with at Matterhorn and the Cold Project, at Orphan's Kitchen. So it was always our style. Will's like English Kiwi, I'm Filipino. And so we kind of merged that together. And then when he moved to Canada, I took over the Cold Project by myself. And so I had a little bit more leeway to showcase my own sort of personal heritage. But it's always been like, I think...
Explain a little bit of what the Cult Project was.
So the Cult Project it's still going. Like, it's a pop-up restaurant. So essentially similar sort of ethos as Bar Magda. It's inspired by the seasons, inspired by, you know, who we are now as people in present time. So whatever they probably experienced from 2016, from some of the dishes that they've tried, that was me at 2016. And then whatever the last dishes they probably tried 2021 at La Fuente, that was me at, you know, at January 2021. And what people would have tasted now at Bar Magda is me at, like, you know, July 2021. So
I think that's such an interesting concept. Even for me as a home cook, my food is such a representation of sort of where I'm at in my life and how I'm feeling and where things are going. And I think that's really interesting to be able to watch your personal evolution through your
It's like
your
the
food.
Temperature outside, the articles that you're reading, the restaurants that you're inspired by. It's like all of those things become, you know, like I was just saying before that, we've got people coming for dinner tonight and they eat plant-based quite a lot. And I was thinking, I texted me like, I think I'm going to make fresh pasta. How do we feel about pork ragu? And they wrote back, they were like, sounds fucking awesome, do it. You know, and it's like, it has to be something that you feel like and that it feels like it's a special treat and it feels relevant to today. It's
Has to be personal. You know, I think that's something that people should expect when they go to Bar Magda, is that like it is personal. You know, whatever they sort of see, taste, or feel, it is something that is personal or who we are at that moment of time and place.
Can I ask a question? Is it typical of your family culture to be so hardworking? Not many chefs on their day off come in and work front of house.
Yes, I guess. Well, both my parents were quite sort of firm on being ambitious, being ambitious doesn't mean that you want to take over the world. It's more like, you know, what is your ambition for yourself? And I was always brought sort of that way. So, you know, like my mom and dad always told me that, like, you know, you have to work hard for what you get. Mm. No one is ever going to hand you over anything to you for free.
And is it true that the Philippines has quite high unemployment?
Yes and no. I mean, like, now that there's COVID and stuff, like, you see how sort of resilient and sort of creative Filipinos are. Now they're doing this online sort of they sell online. A lot of my friends, like, they start selling online stuff and whatnot. And so, you know,
I'm just angling towards, now you're a Kiwi, can we bag Kiwis a bit? Do you think that there's a difference in work ethic? I mean, I was speaking to a Filipino employee recently, and she has a similar ethos to what you've just said, like, be grateful for the job, no one has to give you anything. And I was speaking to her about whether that was typical of her family culture, and she said, yeah, absolutely, because there is, you know, we know people that don't have jobs and can't find jobs, and so...
I think it comes from an economic aspect as well. Like, you know, Philippines is a third world country. Like, I grew up in sort of that environment, although, like, I wouldn't say, like, oh, you know, I was... I didn't have anything to eat or whatever, or my parents, it wasn't that, but I was exposed to it. I saw it. So I was always growing up, I was like, I don't want to be in that position. So I should always remind myself to work hard and at least try harder. And also when I moved here, because I moved here by myself, I was like, shit, I can't get fired. I can't lose a job.
Totally.
Because if I lose a job, then I'm going to pay rent.
How is hospitality viewed in the Philippines as a career? Is it seen as a viable, like, respected career choice?
It depends on which level of hospitality you're in, I think. But for the longest time, when I first started culinary, like, it wasn't really deemed, like, the term chef wasn't really used that heavily.
Is it cook?
It was more of a cook or a cocinero.
Yeah.
Like, you know, even my grandfather was, like, outraged. He was like, why?
You're doing what?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I just finished, like, nursing. I was meant to go to med school, and then he heard I went to cooking school instead, and he was like, all the years of studying and you're just going to go in the kitchen.
I mean, you know my mum, and imagine when I gave up law for selling chicken.
Yeah.
She's like, you what?
Yeah.
So you trained as a nurse first?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. And then,
and there's heaps of Filipinos in healthcare here, aren't
there? Yes. Because as a kid, I had, like, a lot of sort of different aspirations in life. But, like, the end goal was always to own a restaurant.
Yeah.
And then my dad kind of, like, knocked my head a little bit. Well, if you want to own a restaurant, then why are you studying this, you know?
Right.
Like, making the money is one thing, but understanding how the industry works and, you know, how business works, that's different. So you need to learn or work in the industry to actually get into it. And that's when I started, okay, sweet. I got the blessing from my dad, so maybe I can switch, which I did.
Has your grandfather tried any of your food and been like, oh, all right, I understand now?
Yes, they have, actually. Like, the first year that I was in my apprenticeship in culinary, I did cater for the family's Christmas party, and, you know, they had all tried my food. And I did, like...
they still talk about it.
You know, which is good. And then it wasn't until maybe when I moved overseas and, you know, my grandfather realized, oh, yeah, you know, like, he's making something out of himself. You know, it's not the typical sort of office job that, like, everyone's been sort of accustomed to, like, you know, or what people would normally align what successful profession is.
I feel like that's just a capitalist thing, isn't it? We've just become to worship people that are in offices. Like, we get a lot of, when through Bird on a Wire, we hired a lot of Indian migrants, and they were being, like, hammered by their parents at home to get a job in an office and, like, answer phones. I'm like, really? You know, but it's just the way that we're programmed, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the uniform that, like, you know, that people see as something prestigious. If you wear a suit, then it's like, it's prestigious, you know? I think that's the American side of us.
I think you'll see when the big law firm booking comes in that you guys are a bit more prestigious on the fun side than them.
Can you tell me a little bit about how would you characterize it or explain Filipino food? Because for me, eating at your restaurant on Wednesday night, what stood out was this really interesting relationship between sourness and sharp flavors and quite rich... you know, umami with the parmesan custard and the fattiness of those lamb ribs balanced out with the, what's the green sauce?
The green sambal.
The green sambal. Yeah.
And I find Filipino food quite sweet, and you haven't even said sweet. So I'm interested in what Carlo's going to say.
Yeah, I think, because I'm from the South, and that's something that I'm, you know, that's my narrative. That's what I'm representing really mainly in the context of, like, Filipino cooking or flavors. Which is quite unrepresented, actually, because a lot of like the Filipino flavors that people have been accustomed to, not just here, but even the U.S., are your fiesta foods or people that normally showcase on parties or big gatherings. But for me, I grew up in the South. There's a lot of like the sourness that you're talking about, those sort of rich umami, fresher flavors, because we're a very coastal area. That's where I grew up. So that's why I think that was a dish that you had was a kohlrabi with the coconut saffron aioli. So it's a nice sort of contrast between creamy with fresh, punchy flavors. Because the South is actually a mix of a very heavy influence of like Indo-Malay, because it's quite close to Indonesia and Malaysia. And then, of course, having that Spanish colony. You get those sort of Spanish, Latin flavors there as well. And then with this American settlement, that's where the sort of Parmesan custard comes from, the whole American processed cheese whiz that I grew up with. So a lot of them are like just, again, going back to it's a personal thing. So it's my personal relationship to food and sort of my own sort of food memories that I grew up with.
And what's the North, the flavors of the North, what are they like?
I guess a lot of it that I've seen or tasted would be, you definitely see more of those stews, those braised, you know, like darker sauces, as opposed to like really in the South. You get that as well. But we do cook with a lot of like coconuts.
A bit fresher.
You do get a lot of those spices as well.
Is nanam food from the North?
Yes, I would. Yeah. I would say their style would be more on the northern approach. Although they touch base here and there with certain southern style cooking, but most of the flavors that I've seen would be more up north. Like for example, adobo is actually mainly up north, and that's the one that everyone always asks every Filipino, "Oh, do you cook adobo?"
Yeah, mm-hmm.
You know, I was like, yes and no.
Yeah.
So Carlo's brought in some of the delicious Parmesan custard for us and some bread. So we're going to have a really quick break for a snack and we'll be right back.
Raising capital or taking your business to the world? Investment Fix has the lowdown on everything you need to make it happen. This season, we're exploring the US market, the opportunities it offers, what it takes to grow a business there, and the best way to approach investors. Join some of the superstars of the investment and business world as they share advice from their time in the US so you can make your mahi count in this massive market. The Investment Fix podcast, brought to you by Invest New Zealand. Tune in today.
Talo for Lover. I'm Madeline Chapman, editor at The Spinoff. If you have the means, consider supporting our high-quality journalism by becoming a Spinoff member. Sign up now at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
So what I love about that Parmesan custard is it's got this crazy, it's kind of trashy.
Yeah.
But kind of real.
Cheese whiz.
Kind of fancy at the same time.
Cheese in a can, yeah?
Yeah, that's the inspiration, is that the way the American influence has become so popular in the Philippines, but it's still got a real highbrow, lowbrow balance to it, and it's
how do you
delicious.
Make this?
So essentially, it's like making a lemon curd.
Yeah.
But you know, instead of adding lemon, we add cheese to it, and all of the different things.
So speaking of Wellington on a plate, you're heading down at the end of August.
Yes.
To be one of the collaborations with Cinderella. Cinderella's wine bar in the Te Aro Valley. And can you tell us about what you'll be doing? Because I love, one of my favourite parts of Wellington on a Plate each year is the collaborative chef events.
Yes.
I love watching the way different chefs influence each other and what it brings out in them. Can you talk about your relationship with Cinderella and the plans for the event?
Yeah, so this one will be a quite interesting and fun one for sure, because Jimmy, the man behind Cinderella, we used to work together. We were flatmates at one stage as well. So like we know each other very well. So it'd be nice to sort of come together again and sort of bounce back ideas. I was just on the phone with him actually the other day, talking about how we're going to approach the whole menu and how we're going to make it like more of a full collaboration rather than like I do a dish, you do a dish. So he was asking me, so what would you like to showcase? and then we can go from there. So the idea is we'll probably be showcasing some of the staples at Bar Magda and then present them in a slightly different light. So it's not so much of a giveaway. So if you're from Wellington, you get to try certain flavors, say a sauce, but then you come up to Bar Magda and then you can be like, ah, so this is the whole dish, you know, rather than giving away the whole dish over there.
Yeah, just taking something from your restaurant and serving it again in a different space.
Yeah.
I really loved it. And I think it's something that's become relatively new in the hospitality scene in New Zealand is the idea of chefs sharing visions and embracing that potential of collaboration, whereas chefs have previously, you know, can be quite single-minded and one-eyed on the way they approach food, and it's been hard to let others in. And I think it's something Wellington does especially well.
Yeah. No, it's good. Like, Wellington has a very good sort of hospitality culture. I was, you know, I've lived and worked there for a few years, so it's quite exciting. And, you know, even I need to actually get hold of Lance from Cambridge Road, because he's one of the collaborators as well. So essentially what's going to happen is we're going to try some of his wines that he wants us to showcase. And then, again, that's another sort of game changer there, because we have to sort of work with the flavors that works well with his wines. And that's normally how I actually did like the pop-ups at the Cold Project. Was Lance used to send me like his wines or any winemaker, and then from the wines, I write the menu. And it's the same format that we did at Bar Magda as well. So we wrote the drinks list first.
Wow.
Waited for the boys to finish the cocktail list. That's why I was hassling them. I was like, hurry up, because I need to write the food menu. Finalize this, and then I wrote the wine menu, and then based off that, we, you know, I presented them the food menu. So it sits nicely, you know, because then you, in a casual setting, you're not really looking for a match, but you're looking for something that is pleasurable all the way around. So, you know, nothing is too offensive or nothing is too sort of sweet for a certain dish, or same vice versa.
It feels really holistic rather than making decisions based on things that are already done.
Yeah.
It's about building a really cohesive idea for an entire experience.
Yeah. When did you learn about wine?
I was actually at Matterhorn, because like the team over there, they always invite me for trainings, you know. But it wasn't really till I worked at Love Bucket. And then, of course, Meg was there as well.
We had Meg on the podcast.
Yeah. So, you know, and Meg really gave me a lot of insights about wine, how to perceive wine not just as a product, but also as an instrument, you know, as a tool that you can use to sort of get people engaged into a space or into what you're doing. And it was so interesting, because that's when I had the idea of like, oh, why don't I do, I sort of taste the wines first before I write the menu. And Meg was telling me like, actually, that's a good idea, because, you know, more often than not, the wine is already there. Like, you know, you have some wines that's already been sitting in the cellar for the last couple of years. The season, like now, winter, it's just happening.
Yeah.
Produce is just coming up. So if you've tasted the wines and you could be like, sweet, what's in season? Red cabbage. Goes with red cabbage, goes with beetroots. Maybe I can make my own ricotta with that one as well. And it kind of changed my perspective of cooking, you know, made me a lot more patient actually as well, of like, sweet, I need to sort of taste certain things first and then see what the season brings and what would be more appropriate. So it was a Love Bucket. I was there for about like 2 years too. So having to try all those sort of different wines that we that we had was great. You know?
She's so clever, right? Yeah. It just feels to me like so razor sharp. It's as though she's tasting something that is completely different to the last thing she tasted, but it just might be a nuanced difference. You know, like you just train your palate. It's so impressive.
Yeah, and also just like even for me, when I first started managing Jamaisy Street, she was actually the one who also sort of gave me advice and sort of like, sweet, how do you price wine, you know, based on the certain demographic that, like, say, a establishment targeting, you know, so you don't alienate them, so you get them engaged. And so she gave me a few sort of tips. And then when we started opening it up to having New Zealand wines, she sent out her contacts to me and then also introduced me to them, and which is why, like, I'm very well looked after at the moment as well. At Bar Magda with like our sort of reps and whatnot because through her, so which is great.
I think she represents something that we talked about at the beginning of the podcast, and that skill in translating the kitchen and the wines to the people. She's not just got an amazing palate, but Meg is a really amazing communicator about food and wine.
And wine's got like an elitist kind of reputation, but
she breaks that right down.
Yeah.
And that's why hospitality can't be, you know, the front of house hospitality cannot be considered a low skilled job. It's an art.
Oh, not at all. Like, you know, like it's pretty much you're solving problems on the go. You know, you don't have a deadline for it. You don't have a week's deadline. You have now.
Yeah.
The table's here. It's about to be turned and the next booking's arrived. What do you do?
Yeah, totally.
You have to think smart and have to look so relaxed in front of everyone.
Yeah.
While doing it.
When you're panicking, you're like a, you know, head above water and you're just like panicking underneath.
Yeah.
I remember, you know, my favorite memories from hospitality is, you know, doing big fuck ups, but trying really hard to make sure the customer never noticed about it. That was like the most important thing was, if no one knows, it didn't happen, right?
Yeah, totally. Hey, what are you feeling the most proud about with Bar Magda?
I guess it's the whole space, you know, because it does bring everything together into fruition. When we saw the space, like, I kind of knew that it wasn't just going to be a restaurant. And all the sort of little things that I personally felt like that is needed in, say, an establishment, we try to sort of bring it together. Mm-hmm. Which is why when, you know, the guys really wanted to sort of open a bar, but they also knew that, like, sweet, a bar normally doesn't have service around 7 to 9. It's normally, like, before 7, after 9 o'clock. And so that's how it all worked out. And then dividing the space was really the crucial thing. That's why it's divided into sort of bar and bistro.
I remember speaking to you about it at the time.
Because I think that's so important. And so from the get-go, you're meeting clients' expectations. So if you book the bar dining, you kind of know it's a little bit more fun, a little bit louder, a bit more echoey. So if you're into that, that's fine. You know, the bistro, less echoey, so Emerald would probably love it.
Yeah, I remember you saying we want to look after the boomers and the people that don't want noisy restaurants.
Yeah, but they still
want
to be part of it.
To be part of it too.
Yeah,
the big curtains really help. Like it is acoustically, it feels like you've thought about it, which is a rare decision. That's a whole other podcast though.
No, but like, even for us, like dividing the bar area, we had like we have a small curtain there as well because the bar area is divided into bar dining and sort of bar drinking area. That's probably where you were sat last time. And the reason why we had that curtain is because when you go out for drinks, you don't want to be surrounded by people eating because it destroys the sort of, I want a sort of, you know, low key drinking area and then everyone's like eating. It's sort of like fast paced and you
feel like you're in their space.
Yeah, exactly. So we wanted to divide it. And also it's just nice to have a space for people going out just for drinks to be welcome at 7 o'clock and be like, yeah, we have a table for you. Doesn't matter if we're doing dinner service. We have a table for you. You know,
I was so excited to see your opening hours.
Yeah.
I think Auckland has been underserved by good spots that you can eat sort of after 9:30 after 10.
Yeah.
And it was cool to see Ghost Street is open until really late. You're open until really late.
Interesting as a parent, like things I didn't really think about before, but there was a period of time where I was like, let's do dinner really early so we can like get home and get the baby to bed.
Yeah.
And now I'm like, let's go out at 8:30 after the baby's down and the babysitter's there and then bugger off and have a nice relaxing night. So it's funny. Yeah.
So Sophie, we know that your child sleeps really, really well. Have you ever just nipped up to Under Armour and left her sleeping on her own?
So we used to live like directly opposite Under Armour and we had a lot of talks about how far the baby monitor would reach. And I was like, if the baby monitor would reach that far, I reckon I'd do it. But then, and it didn't, but there's a new phone app where you can, it does reach. And people say in hotels, you can like go down to the hotel restaurant with the baby upstairs. And sometimes the hotel restaurant's like around the corner and down the stairs and whatever. People are doing it.
Because a couple of times I've left the boys sleeping under the protection of the dog and drop Millie up to the Titirangi village. So, you know, that's like a 7-minute round trip. Yeah. That feels like quite a long time.
Yeah. Quite loose parenting.
Yeah.
Your dog's really responsible.
Yeah.
Hey, so I'm looking through the 3 events that Cinderella is putting on for Wellington on a Plate, and basically I need to move to Wellington for the entire month of August. Yeah. On 3 Sundays, Sunday the 15th of August, so we'll be there. We could go to the Cinderella and her lovely sisters collaboration with Lillian.
It's sold out.
Oh, we're highly influential food podcasters. We'll just be at
we'll just tell them that that's part of our rider. Yeah.
And then on Sunday, August 22nd, Cinderella and her lovely sister Ada is collaborating with James. And then, of course, on Sunday, August 29, Carlo and Bar Magda will be there for their collaboration. So get in and get tickets because, as Sophie mentioned, shit's selling out really quick.
It's quite hectic. You should actually get on the website today.
Book your Airbnb for 3 weeks and just invest yourself in that city. And if you live in Wellington and you're listening, I'm just so jealous right now.
Yeah. Have fun, Wellingtonians.
Yeah.
Is that what you call yourselves?
That is correct. Yep.
Cool.
So thank you so much for joining us, Carlo. Congratulations
Huge congratulations. Yeah. You should be so proud of yourself.
Thank you so much.
I bet you're exhausted, but honestly, the thing that stands out about all your chat is the energy. Like, you've got so much energy for it.
Yeah.
And please get on to visawoap.co.nz.com. I'm looking at
.com.
Book your tickets. Join us on August 15, 3 to 5 p.m. Parrot Dog, Lyle Bay. You don't need a ticket for that. It's just free. Show up.
That's not reflective of the quality of the talent.
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not.
We're big believers in gifting ourselves to the people. We're really excited to see you all in person. And we will be talking to you again soon. Ka kite.
Ka kite.
Bye.
See ya.
Kia ora e te iwi, Te Aihe Butler here, podcast manager at The Spinoff. If you enjoy listening to our podcasts, consider supporting our mahi by signing up to become a Spinoff member at thespinoff.co.nz/donate.
The Spinoff Podcast Network.